I'm John Weigelt. I will be the moderator. I guess I have to call myself a surgeon in transition. I am transitioning from the Medical College of Wisconsin out to the University of South Dakota as I change my focus to just education, although I will remain active in critical care. I've had the pleasure of working with these ladies and gentlemen and colleagues up at the podium, and as was mentioned by Jonah, we were given the task of doing a little deeper dive on this issue of pain management. And so what you're going to hear a little bit of repeat, but you're also going to hear a little bit of more detailed examination of the problem, a little bit hopefully about prevention, and then some very specific patient populations, the geriatric population, the patient who is a chronic dependent on substance, and then finally somebody who can give you some insight into that alternate or multimodal management from a surgical perspective. So we're going to start with our guest anesthesiologist. Rich Rosenquist from Cleveland Clinic is going to give us a perspective of how much trouble we can get into with opioids. So.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here this morning and to have the opportunity to share some thoughts about what's going on with the opioid crisis. And when I started in pain medicine, which is more than 30 years ago now, I never imagined that my life would look like it does today, or that I would spend as much time saying the word no. So as we go through this, I want to talk about some of the risks for subsequent opioid misuse in surgical patients, because part of my everyday life now is people who come into me who have been sustained on long-term opioids, and somebody tells them that the dope fairy lives at the Cleveland Clinic pain management department, and all they need to do is walk in the door, and I will happily prescribe their 200 morphine equivalents a day. And they're horribly disappointed when they come in to see me, and they find out that I'm not going to do that. So I'd like to prevent those things for my own personal well-being and for the well-being of all these patients. I don't have any conflicts that are relevant to what I'm going to talk about this morning, and I want to talk about ways that we might create and increase patient engagement in perioperative pain management to improve outcomes, and really with the eye of reducing the risk of long-term opioid use. Talk about methods to assess patients for the risk of opioid misuse preoperatively, and describe some of the limitations of the tools we have to help us identify these patients. So who's at risk? Who's likely to turn into a long-term opioid patient? They've identified subsets of patients who have an increased risk of opioid use at 90 days postoperatively. They tend to be low income. They tend to have other comorbidities, whether it be diabetes, heart failure, pulmonary disease, other chronic pain conditions. If somebody has a chronic pain condition, your ears should perk up. Preoperative use of benzodiazepines, antidepressants, and antihypertensive medications. So if people are always looking for a magic pill to make their life better, your ears should go up. We'd like to have a way to do genetic testing, and genetic factors may have a role to help us identify potential opioid addiction, but molecular genetic testing at the present time is not sufficiently advanced to allow us to do that. So we don't have a simple lab test that we can get ahead of time to say, this patient's going to be a problem. How big is the problem with persistent opioid use? Chad Bummett and the group at University of Michigan have done an outstanding job of helping us to clarify and identify some of the issues around here. So they looked at trying to identify who's continuing to use opioids over the long term, and they said an opioid prescription that is fulfilled between 90 and 180 days after the surgical procedure. And they asked the question, is there some difference in risk between minor and major surgical procedures? So when they looked at the two procedures, what they found was with minor it was 5.9%, with major it was 6.5%, right? And if you're a non-operative cohort, by comparison, only 0.4%. So there's something about being exposed to opioids and how long you're exposed to them has something to do with your long-term risk of use. So it's common. It's not significantly different between minor and major surgical procedures. But there are other things that they identified. And the things they identified were behavioral and pain disorders. So if those things were present before surgery, the likelihood went up. So when you put it on a broader scale, the takeaways from this manuscript are that the findings suggest that more than 2 million individuals may transition to persistent opioid use following elective surgery every year. It's not simply the consequence of poorly controlled pain around the time of the operation. Because the patients get the medications from us, and you're their doctor, they may correctly or incorrectly assume that what you give them is safe, and they can just continue to use it the way you prescribed it to them, and there's no risk at all. And sometimes, because other things hurt, it's nice to have a little extra stash around, and you can use those for the back pain or the knee pain or the ankle pain or something else. Other things, psychiatric conditions, are definitely associated with long-term opioid use, and they may use these pain medications to treat affective disorders instead of pain disorders. So I just don't like the way I feel today. I'm a little bit stressed out. I'm going to take the medication. And they also found that there was regional variation depending on prescribing practices. So there was more persistent opioid use in the East and the West, South, Central United States. So why and how does the problem persist? Well, some of it has to do with inadequate preoperative education regarding pain management, assessing the risk of opioid use, and then expectation setting. And we hear a lot about this. But the other thing is that there's a quiet transference from one prescriber to another that makes the problem less apparent. So if you've been prescribing all along and all of a sudden the patient quit asking you for the medication, your assumption is everything is fine, right? No news has got to be good news. Not necessarily so. So this group went out and they looked at the transitions of care for post-op opioid prescribing in previously opioid-naive patients in the USA. And this is a retrospective review, right? So remember, this is patients who are not taking opioids before their surgery, not the group that is necessarily high risk. We know from the previous study that new persistent opioid use is relatively common, and these are people who continue to fill opioid prescriptions 3 to 6 months after surgery. When you looked at who was doing it, in the first 3 months after surgery, surgeons accounted for 69% of all the opioid prescriptions. Primary care, 13%. Emergency medicine, 2%. PM&R and pain medicine accounted for 1%. And all other specialties, 15%. 9 to 12 months after surgery, right? Now, long after surgery, surgeons accounted for only 11% of the opioid prescriptions. Primary care physicians accounted for 53% of them. Emergency medicine, 5%. PM&R pain medicine, 6%. And all other specialties, 25%. So they quietly transferred over to their primary care provider to continue to get these pain medications 9 to 12 months after the surgery, long after they should have been off these medications. So just the takeaway, by 9 to 12 months after surgery, the majority of opioid prescriptions were provided by primary care physicians and no longer by the surgeons. And it argues that we should have enhanced coordination between the surgeons and the primary care providers in the community so that they understand that your intent, hopefully, maybe, is not that the patient should continue to get pain medications ad infinitum after their surgical procedure. So to the extent that they come off, as described in previous lectures this morning, in a timely fashion, it won't be an issue. But if they're going out in the community and you find out that your primary care providers are picking up prescriptions that you had no intent of the patient continuing, hopefully there's a communication that goes forth so it can be avoided in the future. There are tools out there to try and assess the potential for misuse. There are a lot of them out there. Opioid risk tool, the stratification tool for opioid risk mitigation, what's called the SOPR, the screener and opioid assessment for patients with pain, a dire score, and there's another one for patients that are currently taking called a current opioid misuse measure. All of these things have similar types of questions, but when you look at the risk factors, right, alcohol, illegal drugs, prescription drugs, right, in your family, alcohol, illegal drugs, or prescription drugs in your own personal use, your age, do you have a history of sexual abuse, do you have a history of psychological abuse, do you have depression, and what's the score? And the higher the score, the higher the risk. And they're not perfect, but if you see these things or you have any history of those things, be aware that they're at much higher risk of long-term opioid use. They were primarily designed to assess potential risk prior to starting chronic opioid therapy or as a means of assessing misuse during therapy. But when you look at the other things that have been published, assessment of other factors, depression and other things, are probably as important or maybe even more important in determining the relative risk of perioperative or long extended use of opioids. Patient engagement is critically important, and pre-op education and expectation, follow-up, and then making expectation and reality meet. And if expectation is here and reality is here, everybody's going to get disappointed on both sides of the equation. So you really have to make an effort to deliver what you set the expectation for. So in setting expectations, surgery will involve pain. Pain's going to get better every day. We're going to treat your pain. It's not that we're not going to treat your pain. We're going to treat your pain, and we're going to use a variety of methods and medications. The amount of pain medication will decrease as your recovery progresses. You will be completely weaned off opioid pain medications. That sentence should come out of your mouth before they ever come in the hospital. You will also receive other non-opioid pain medications. Pain control is important, and it relates to functional goals, right? These are things that you have to do in terms of setting up that. You need to tell them the type of pain and the duration. If you use other approaches, whether it be interventions such as regional blocks or epidural blocks, what kind of medications you're going to give them, local treatments, alternative treatments, whether you've got things like Reiki or music massage or virtual reality or other things available to you, tell the patient what's going to be available to them, what they can use, and what your typical approach is. The follow-up is critically important. You have to daily round with an emphasis on reiterating the perioperative pain plan and meeting the functional goals. And make every effort for expectation of reality to be consistent. I'll just give you one example from our own institution. We do a little bit of heart surgery in Cleveland Clinic. Our LVAD patients, up until recently, had a near 100% persistent use of opioids 1 year after their LVAD implant. Okay? About a year and a half ago, 2 years ago now, we said, this has got to change. The Heart and Vascular Institute approached us, and a multidisciplinary team sat down and said, let's start changing expectations and changing the management. But the biggest thing that we did was change expectations. So now during their 3-week hospitalization, they are weaned off of opioids almost completely. And now about 85% of the patients leave the hospital on no opioids after 3 weeks. 15% are on, and 2 weeks later, the majority of those are off. But we went from near 100% to near zero by 2 weeks post-discharge just by changing expectations and then making sure that every single day we go in and reiterate the plan and make sure that the plan is actually delivered. When you use that multimodal approach, steadily move away from the opioids. Cut them down every single day. And if pain remains a problem, go back and ask yourself clinically, is there some other reason for ongoing surgical pain that is out of line with what I normally expect? Ask whether or not it's their chronic back pain that's contributing to the problem and not the surgical incision. And also make sure that you're addressing the need to look at things like psychological contributions such as anxiety or a difficult diagnosis. And so if you just say, what's the diagnosis? If somebody comes in for a laparotomy because they've got a mass in their abdomen, when you come in to see them in recovery room, you say, it was a benign mass, we got everything out, everybody's happy. If you say, We did everything that we could. We're going to be setting you up to meet with an oncologist. All of a sudden, the expectations are entirely different. So one thing, I'm completely relieved. The second one, what's going to happen to me? I've got an uncertain future. So counseling for discharge, set expectations, set norms, use non-opioids, tell them how to use them appropriately, warn them about adverse effects, and tell them about safe disposal. So what I want you to walk away with, risk factors for prolonged or inappropriate opioid use can be identified preoperatively, and it doesn't require extensive questioning, right? Simple things that are obtained in a usual history and physical can help to identify patients who are at high risk. Education and expectation setting are critical elements in reducing overall opioid use and reducing the risk of long-term opioid use. And then postoperative planning should definitely include a defined plan to eliminate opioid use as healing progresses. And I thank you very much for your attention.